Back again to the Bad Quaker podcast, where liberty is our mission. Today is Monday, April 15th, 2013, and this is podcast number 301, so-called Patriot Day. Patriot Day. April 15th, Tax Day, Patriot Day. You know, I probably ought to just push my notes to the side and just go off on that. But I'm not. I'm not going to do that. I have a little bit of self-discipline. Not a lot. A little bit. So, announcements. I actually have some fairly important announcements. So let's just try to get past the obvious theft that's taking place today and get some business done here. Porkfest 10, as I've been talking about for a long time now, Porkfest 10 will be June 17th through 23rd, 2013 at the Rogers Campground in Lancaster, New Hampshire. It is it's going to be a lot of fun. I don't know what to say other than you need to be there. It's just, I was there last year. My first time there was last year, and it was just a lot of fun. It was a really good time. I'll be speaking on Monday at 11 a.m. on Central Planning versus Spontaneous Order, and I'll be speaking Friday at noon on Discovering and Defeating Statist Thinking. So if you can at all make it, I would encourage you to get out to Porkfest this year. Porkfest is always good. It's always a lot of fun. Now, there's a big change. Seacoast Annual Freedom Expo is going to be Saturday, April 27th, and it was going to be in Exeter at the Exeter Town Hall, but how do you put this? Lightning struck the Exeter Town Hall. I guess that's what happens when, never mind. Okay, so it's going to be held, let's see, I'll read the thing, how it's written here. Due to the fire at Exeter Town Hall, the event has been forced to move to the Trinity Parish House, Route 1, at 29 Main Street in Seabrook, New Hampshire, and that's right on the border with Massachusetts. So this is going to be good news to the people who are headed there from the southern parts of New England. It'll be less travel for you. So once again, that's going to be the Seacoast Annual Freedom Expo. It's going to be at the Trinity Parish House, Route 1 at 29 Main Street in Seabrook, New Hampshire. Okay, and also, my wife and I have just yesterday finally got around to it. We have been intending to for a while, but we finally got our tickets and our reservations set up, although we haven't got the actual confirmation yet, but I'm sure that's coming. And what am I talking about? Of course, I'm talking about the first annual Midwest Peace and Liberty Fest, hosted by the Michigan Peace and Liberty Coalition. This is going to take place at the Brighton Recreation Area in Brighton, Michigan. And if you can, come on out and join us. It's going to be a long weekend of peace, liberty, and family-friendly camping. There's not really a big agenda. They're not in any way trying to compete with Porkfest or anything like that. It's just a real informal gathering, get together, have a campfire, talk, get to meet each other, maybe, you know, roast a hot dog or something and just get to know each other and have some fun. And that's going to be Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, August 17th, 18th, and 19th. And the registration is now open. You can get over there, save the dates, spread the word, and I hope to see you there. And once again, I wanted to mention the Bad Quaker Top 40 podcasts on the Bad Quaker forum. We're trying to put together a list of our top 40 podcasts so that we can maybe make a CD out of it, and maybe Michael over there at the Freedom Fiends is working with some of his fellow fiends. And they're going to try to put up the top 40 Bad Quaker podcasts on the torrents so that it lives forever. Now, we also have another big piece of news, and this comes to me. Davi, my friend over there at Bitcoins Not Bombs, sent me a letter today, and I'm just going to read this to you here. It says, I'm writing to you on behalf of FR33 Aid, or Free Aid, with some exciting news for both the Liberty Movement and the Bitcoin community. In an attempt to protect themselves from asset confiscation, FR33 Aid applied for nonprofit status in April of 2012, and they've been entrenched in the bureaucracy ever since. Today, FR33 Aid is declaring their financial independence by abandoning their IRS application and adopting Bitcoin as their primary financial instrument. FR33 Aid determined that their attempts to comply with the confusing demands of the IRS were not only unnecessary, but counterproductive to their mission of providing medical and educational services at liberty-oriented events and demonstrating the value of voluntary mutual aid. By making the courageous transition into a Bitcoin-based organization, they will be able to retain complete control over their assets and circumvent complex and burdensome requirements of state-regulated banks and focus those energies on their important mission. And I want to say congratulations to Stephanie Murphy. She's the doctor that runs the joint over there, and she's director of operations at FR33 Aid. They serve an important purpose, and I'm just thrilled that they have made this leap away from, you know, government permission and all that kind of thing, and on their own. And I wish them the best in this. This is not an easy choice. That, you know, they didn't make an easy choice here. They made a very hard choice, and it could be a dangerous choice. So I wish them the best in that. And I would say that, you know, you see the FR33 Aid people. You'll see them at Porkfest if you go there. You see them all over the place. They provide. Well, you know what happened at Porkfest last year? There was a person visiting there from Europe, and this person had some food allergies. And unbeknownst to them, they accidentally ingested some food that caused a really serious reaction. And the FR33 Aid people rushed to this person's side, contacted the emergency services, got an ambulance, got them out of there, got them to the hospital, and made sure that they. I mean, it literally, this person could have. I don't know if it was bad enough for them to die or not, but in allergy situations with food allergies like that, death is always a possibility. And the FR33 people just flew into action. It was really great to see it. So it's an important thing, and I'll put a link to FR33 Aid's website in today's show notes, and it would probably be good to get over there and give them a visit and see what they're up to. All right, now, after all of that, and I wanted to make one more mention. I appreciate the donors that have been, for the last couple of weeks, have been trying to help us out in our attempts to get enough money together to go to Porkfest and to go to the first annual Midwest Peace and Liberty Fest. We really appreciate the donations. They're, you know, they really help us out, and we're trying to get an individual email back to each person who does. So if you've donated and you haven't got your email yet, just take a look for it. It should be there pretty soon. We're just trying to keep up. Okay, so now, would the government lie to us? Into our topic for today. Truthfulness. No, not truthfulness in government. That's just ridiculous. Would the government lie to you? Well, you know, I could have. Hey, I did a series on war, and I went back to the War of 1812. And, you know, American children are told that the American War of 1812 was, the schools use phrases like the Second American Revolution. And they say things like, oh, well, American sailors were being conscripted by the British Navy and forced to serve on British ships, and these are given as the excuses for the War of 1812. And of course, like I showed in my series on wars, that's all an absolute lie. The American War of 1812 was an attempt by the American government to invade and conquer Canada. It was their attempt, and they made two different attempts to invade Canada and annex it and make it part of the United States. That was their open and blatant purpose in going to war in 1812. And this wasn't hidden for a long time. There was no dishonor in it up to the point of where the U.S. lost the War of 1812. And when the U.S. lost the War of 1812, then it began making excuses as to why, you know, the politicians started making excuses as to why they had gone into the war to begin with, because they had utterly failed in their attempt. And it was not massed British armies that stopped them from invading Canada. It was Canadian militia protecting their own land that kept the United States from conquering Canada. And my reason for bringing that up is because if I went back and started documenting all the lies that are told to the American public by the American government, well, this would have to be like a 40-hour podcast, just this one show, and so I can't do that. So I decided, when in reference to starting to talk about government lies, I decided, you know what? What if I just stick with the lies that the government told during my lifetime? What if I just did a show and just started talking about the major lies, not all the little tiny lies that are here and there all over the place that the government likes to do, but what if I did a show just talking about the lies that the government has told me since I've been alive? And I thought, okay, well, where do we start this? Well, let's start it with Francis Gary Powers and the 1960 U2 incident. And the U2 incident did not involve an Irish band. The U-2 was a spy plane that flew very high up in the sky and took very very unusual pictures of the ground. I don't have time to get into that. Very weird camera that it used. Anyway, so then I'm going to try to blaze through these notes, and you try to keep up with the lies told by the United States government just during my lifetime. The Gary Powers incident, or the Gary Powers U-2 incident, happened in 1960. The U.S. had been violating Soviet airspace for 4 years in what could only be considered an open act of war. The Soviet Union had warned the D.C. government in 1955 that any violations of their airspace would be considered an act of war. And the U.S. Administration, under the guiding hand of Eisenhower, chose to commit this act of war over and over. From 1957, I think, was their first flyovers. But either way, they continued doing it over and over and over until in 1959. Now, at first, I should say, at first, even though the Soviet Union had warned that if the D.C. government flew into Soviet airspace, it would be an act of war, the Soviet Union had a problem. Even though the U.S. was flying, it was doing that. They were violating their airspace in an open act of war. Even though they were doing that, the Soviet Union didn't have a weapon that could reach the 70,000-foot elevation where these U-2s were flying. So the Soviet Union didn't have the power to do anything about these flyovers. So they pretended it wasn't happening rather than admit to their own people that the U.S. had an airplane that could fly higher than the Soviet Union even had a rocket that could reach. So in order to save face, all sides kind of pretended like it wasn't happening. But this started to change. By 1959, the Soviets had improved their surface-to-air missiles, and the CIA was the one that was running this operation, running these U-2s, these airplanes. And so by 1959, the Soviet Union had improved their surface-to-air missiles, and the CIA lost their first U-2. It was totally destroyed. And this was very fortunate for the CIA because since the plane was completely destroyed, the Soviet Union could not bring it and say, look, this is an American plane, our airspace has been violated, or whatever. They couldn't do that because the plane had been completely destroyed. Now, on this, now at that point, you would think that those in government, the decision makers who were doing this would have said, well, That's it. We can't keep doing this. They're going to shoot him down now. But they didn't. They flew it again. And this time, May 1st, 1960, CIA pilot Francis Gary Powers took off from a CIA base in Pakistan, and he was headed for another CIA base in Norway, flying a sort of a zigzag pattern across the Soviet, right across the main body of the Soviet Union. Now, we know that the Soviet Union fully expected this flight and was already on red alert when Powers entered Soviet airspace. We know this now, and the CIA knew it then. The CIA knew that the Soviets were waiting. The CIA knew that the Soviets were on complete full red alert. And so what happened? Well, of course, as soon as Gary Powers gets well into Soviet airspace, they shot him down. 4 days after Powers disappeared, see, the CIA didn't actually know what had happened. All they knew is he was there, then he wasn't there. That was it. That's all they really knew. Well, 4 days after Powers disappears, NASA issued a very detailed press release saying that an aircraft had, you know, in their words, gone missing north of Turkey. North of Turkey. Yeah, well, that's kind of a stretch. This press release speculated that the pilot may have fallen unconscious and that the plane may have been on autopilot. And and they even went so far as to make the false claim that the pilot reported on an emergency frequency that he was experiencing oxygen difficulties. And to bolster this lie, the entire fleet of The first thing they did was they took a U-2 plane and they painted it with NASA colors and they put it out to show the media. See, it was a weather plane like this one. Of course, it wasn't a weather plane. It was a spy plane. But that's what they did. Okay, so now, once the Soviet Premier Nikita Khrushchev heard about this and heard about the announcement of NASA losing one of their weather planes, then Khrushchev went before the Supreme Soviet, and essentially that means he went before the world because the cameras are on, the microphones are on, and everything. And he announced that a spy plane, an American spy plane, had been shot down, but he intentionally made no reference whatsoever to the pilot. So the Eisenhower administration, NASA involved in the scheme already, and of course we already know the CIA is involved. So the Eisenhower administration intentionally decided that they would deceive the American people and attempt to deceive the world. They assumed, since Khrushchev hadn't mentioned the pilot in any way, and they assumed based on the fact that the last U-2 that got shot down was splattered to pieces and there wasn't that much left of it, so they assumed that the pilot, Gary Powers, had died in the crash. And so the Eisenhower administration keeps pushing this story again. They reiterated the story that it wasn't a spy plane, it was a weather research aircraft, and that it had accidentally strayed into Soviet airspace because the pilot had radioed with these difficulties with his oxygen equipment, and they had evidently passed out and flying over Turkey, and then it just kind of flew on its own and wandered into Soviet airspace. So the Eisenhower White House acknowledged that that might be the same plane that Khrushchev was claiming was a spy plane. But of course, Eisenhower wouldn't lie to the American people. That's that evil Khrushchev lying over there. That's that Russian. He's one of them commies. You know, them commies lie all the time, but Eisenhower would never lie. Eisenhower's a good man, right? Yeah, so Eisenhower lied about it and said that, no, indeed, it was a weather plane. And, the funny thing is, here's the other thing. Eisenhower specifically said that there was absolutely no deliberate attempt to violate Soviet airspace, and there never had been, Eisenhower said this knowing that they had been systematically violating Soviet airspace for, 5 years? Four years that they had been violating Soviet airspace? So on May 7th, Khrushchev he had to have chuckled under his breath as he did this, but he said in front of the Supreme Soviet, he said, "I must tell you a secret." And if I could do a good Russian accent, I would do it. But he said, "I must tell you a secret. When I made my first report, I deliberately did not say that the pilot was alive and well. And now just look how many silly things the Americans have said." In other words, Khrushchev stayed quiet and allowed Eisenhower to lie, and then Khrushchev exposed Eisenhower's lies. You see, not only was Gary Powers still alive, but the plane was mostly intact. The Soviets recovered the surveillance camera and even developed some of the pictures out of it. This incident resulted in a great humiliation for the Eisenhower administration when they were openly caught in this series of lies that they had given to the American people. Then Eisenhower left. And before he left, though, he authorized the invasion of Cuba. And as he left office, he handed it over to John F. Kennedy. John F. Kennedy was shown all the plans of the invasion of Cuba, and John F. Kennedy approved of them. And so in 1961, we begin the next series of lies that I'm going to talk about, and that's the Bay of Pigs. April 13th, 1961, there was an arson attack against a department store in Havana. The CIA operatives, set a department store on fire in Havana, and at least one person died in that fire. Now, that was, in any other case, however you want to look at it, that was an act of terrorism on the part of the CIA against the Cuban government. It was used as an excuse as to why there was supposedly so much hatred against Castro's government. They're even having internal problems like that, when in actuality, it was just part of the setup to the Bay of Pigs. And at that time, on April 13th, the KGB warned the Cuban government that there was about to be a CIA attack, and the CIA knew that the Cuban government had been warned by the KGB. Now, under cover of morning darkness on April 15th, CIA air attacks began. The CIA had bombers and began bombing strategic targets in Cuba. Now, the pilots were Cubans that were trained by the CIA to fly and do that. But this was all CIA money, and, you know, CIA airplanes, everything. The CIA went so far as to take one of their planes that was exactly like those ones involved in the bombings, and they except it wasn't one of those. It was a different plane. It had not been involved in the bombings. And they took the engine covers off, and they shot the engine covers full of holes. And then they put the engine covers back on the planes and had a Cuban national fly this plane into the Miami airport and request an emergency landing, where he landed. And the media took pictures of the bullet holes, and he had this great story how he barely escaped Cuba with his life. And, of course, he was a CIA operative, and the whole thing was a photo op for the CIA. So during these bombing campaigns in the morning of April 15th, by 10:30 that morning, the Cuban foreign minister was at the United Nations, and he accused the U.S. of aggressive airstrikes against Cuba. The U.S. Ambassador to the U.N. was Adlai Stevenson. Adlai Stevenson was you might consider him like Al Gore, the Al Gore of his day. He had come real close to becoming president, but not quite. Anyway, so Adlai Stevenson was at the UN, and the Cuban foreign minister is accusing the U.S. of aggressively attacking Cuba. And so Adlai Stevenson stated that the U.S. armed forces would not, and this is a quote, under any conditions intervene in Cuba. And then he said that maybe, you know, there might be Cuban defectors who were internally, you know, attacking Cuba, but he guaranteed that the U.S. was not involved in any way. And then he used the photo op pictures of the CIA's B-26 that they had parked at the Miami airport. He used those pictures as evidence that this was an internal Cuban affair and it had nothing to do with the U.S. Adlai Stevenson actually was later embarrassed when he realized that the CIA had lied to him and used him like that. But of course, by the time he found it out, it was far too late. The damage had already been done. Adlai Stevenson was silly enough that he actually believed his own government and spoke on its behalf. Kind of reminds me of what some of the Bush administration did in the early days, justifying the wars in Afghanistan and in Iraq. But that's what Adlai Stevenson did. So he stood up there in front of the UN and unknowingly lied to them and justified U.S. aggressions. And then, same day, Kennedy, who was president at the time, issues a statement. And this is a quote. It says, "I have emphasized before that this was a struggle of Cuban patriots against a Cuban dictator. While we could not be expected to hide our sympathies, we made it repeatedly clear that the armed forces of this country would not intervene in any way." Well, on then April 16th, so that was the 15th, April 15th, that took place. April 16th, Kennedy ordered the cancellation of further airstrikes planned for dawn of April 17th. Now, just keep that in mind. He just got through saying that that the U.S. armed forces wouldn't be involved in any way, and then he ordered the cancellation of the airstrikes for the following day on the 17th. And he did that specifically so that he could maintain plausible deniability of U.S. involvement. So he's the one authorizing the bombing. He's the one that calls back the bombing, and yet he can look right at the cameras and say the U.S. is not doing it, right? We believe this, right? So here's Kennedy lying. So then, so the air bombings did not happen on the 17th. But on midnight, that morning, on midnight, April 17th, the CIA's chartered ships, along with at least 10 U.S. Navy frogmen, and I'm saying frogmen because it was about a month later when they were renamed Navy SEALs. But at that time, CIA chartered ships, along with at least 10 U.S. Navy frogmen, began the invasion of Cuba that's now known as the Bay of Pigs. So yes, not only was the CIA involved, not only was it under the direct orders of the President of the United States, who is the Commander-in-Chief of the military, but also U.S. military individuals were involved in that activity. Now, Kennedy, later when this all kind of fell apart and the whole Bay of Pigs invasion failed miserably, Kennedy was so angered about this that he was so angered at the CIA's failure to do this that he declared, quote, that he would, quote, splinter the CIA into 1,000 pieces and scatter it into the winds. Now, in early 1962, Kennedy fired the head of the CIA, Allen Dulles, and unfortunately, because of ongoing relationships with J. Edgar Hoover, this put Kennedy now at odds with both Dulles, as former head of the CIA, and J. Edgar Hoover, who was the current head of the FBI. Now, you think about that for a minute. It's been repeatedly said by CIA people that there's no such thing as a former CIA member. A lot of people, for a long time after that, even said that Allen Dulles never stopped being the head of the CIA. The president could do anything he wanted. Dulles was still the head of the CIA. So then, so that happened in early 62. And then let's step ahead a little bit, step away from the lies that have been told so far to justify Bay of Pigs and justify presidential action that took place. And before we go into the next section, let's just take a little break here. And when I get back, we're going to go to November 1963. Sometime later, for no particular reason, somebody shot that nice young president when he was riding in his car. Do you have an Amazon account? If you don't, let me encourage you to set one up. Setting up an account is free and it's easy, and Amazon has great prices, and in most cases you can avoid paying sales tax. Plus, if you're careful and lump your purchases together, you can get free shipping. And Amazon has almost anything you can think of, plus it's safer and cheaper than driving all over town. When you buy stuff, if you follow the Amazon link at badquaker.com, Amazon will give Bad Quaker a tiny portion of the purchase. It won't cost you any extra, but you'll be supporting this podcast. Thank you. BadQuaker.com uses HostGator as our web hosting service. It was fast and easy to get set up, and the support we receive is top-notch. They have helpful and friendly 24/7, 365 live technical support and a 99.9% uptime guarantee, and they have some of the best prices in the business. If you have a website, or if you want to have a website, check them out by going to badquaker.com and click on the button for HostGator. And thank you very much for supporting badquaker.com. November 1963, Kennedy was dead. A few days later, LBJ formed the Warren Commission to investigate the murder of the President of the United States of America. And who was on the Warren Commission? Well, it's named after Earl Warren, the Chief Justice of the United States. Earl Warren was on the Warren Commission. A guy named Richard Russell, who was a senator. Richard Russell Jr., actually, was a senator. A gentleman by the name of John Sherman Cooper, another senator. A guy by the name of Hale Boggs was a representative. He was the House Majority Leader. A guy, a fairly unknown guy named Gerald Ford, was on the Warren Commission. He was the House Minority Leader at the time. And a guy named John J. McCloy, he was the, oddly enough, the former president of the World Bank. Well, that's an interesting thought. Why would you have the former president of the World Bank on a commission set to investigate why and what the circumstances were for an American president that was assassinated? And then the final member of the Warren Commission was Alan Dulles, the former director of the Central Intelligence Agency and the personal enemy of both JFK and RFK. Isn't that convenient that the guy... one of the people in Washington that had reason to hate Kennedy the most was on the commission that investigated why Kennedy was dead. So the conclusion of the Warren Commission was that
sometime later, for no particular reason, somebody shot that nice young president when he was riding in his car. And a few years after that, somebody shot his little brother, too, only he was in the hotel kitchen.
Must be hard being brothers.
That was the conclusion of the Warren Commission. And you can say it in different ways, but that's essentially it. Forrest Gump history. According to a 1963 FBI memo that was released in 2008, Gerald Ford, a member of the Warren Commission, secretly provided the FBI with information about two of his fellow Warren Commission members, both of whom were unsure about the single gunman story. Another 1963 memo, released in 1978, stated that Gerald Ford volunteered to advise the FBI regarding the content of the commission's deliberations if his involvement with the Bureau was kept confidential, a condition which the Bureau approved of. Ford was an outspoken proponent of the single assassin theory, and according to the same report, Ford had strong ties to the FBI and to the head of the FBI, J. Edgar Hoover. So the president is killed, and we're told that it just happened because he was riding along in his car and somebody shot him for no good reason whatsoever. Now let's step into another lie. This is from Wikipedia. On August 4th, 1964, the United States President Lyndon B. Johnson erroneously claimed that North Vietnamese forces had twice attacked American destroyers in the Gulf of Tonkin, known today as the Gulf of Tonkin Incident. This event spawned the Gulf of Tonkin Resolution of 7th August 1964, ultimately leading to the open war between North Vietnam and the United States. It further foreshadowed the major escalation of the Vietnam War in South Vietnam, which began with the landing of U.S. regular combat troops at Da Nang in 1965. Folks, officially, 58,282 Americans died as a direct result of the Vietnam War. There were millions of Vietnamese died, and an estimated 500,000 children were born in Vietnam with birth defects due to the spraying of Agent Orange alone. The problem with LBJ's declaration, and by the way, he claimed this happened on the open seas. That's what he claimed. He didn't say it happened in a small little gulf, right off of North Vietnamese waters. He claimed in his speech that this happened in the open sea. Well, that was a direct lie. It didn't happen in the open sea. As a matter of fact, it didn't happen. The whole Gulf of Tonkin incident was a lie. There was no attack on August 4th. The U.S. ships involved were not on the high seas, which is, that's international waters. They were within North Vietnam's 200-mile exclusive zone, and some of the U.S. actions on the night of on the morning of August 4th actually violated North Vietnam's 12-mile territorial zone. So they actually were, had they attacked the U.S. Boats, they would have been justified, but they simply did not attack them on that date. There was no attack on August 4th. Now, to keep things in perspective, the Gulf of Tonkin is about the size of Lake Superior. So just to kind of keep that in mind when you're thinking of the Gulf of Tonkin incident. Within 30 minutes of the August 4th incident, President Johnson, this is back from a quote from Wikipedia again, President Johnson had decided on retaliatory attacks. That same day, he used the hotline to call Moscow and assured the Soviets that he had no intention in opening a border war in Vietnam. Early on the 5th of August, Johnson publicly ordered retaliatory measures, stating, "The determination of all Americans to carry out our full commitment to the people and to the government of South Vietnam will be redoubled by this outrage." 1 hour and 40 minutes after that speech, U.S. aircraft were bombing North Vietnamese targets. And that brings up, and so he lied. He lied to get America into the Vietnam War. Over 58,000 American soldiers died because LBJ lied. Because LBJ lied. An entire generation has to live with the fact of the Vietnam War. Used to be a saying when I was a kid, it went like this. "Hey, hey, LBJ, how many kids did you kill today? Hey, hey, LBJ, how many kids did you kill today?" But you know what? War was not palatable. War didn't settle well with the American youth. War just didn't taste good to the young men who had to go and fight it, and to the families that lost them. But unfortunately, the major reason that the war was not palatable to the American people was because of the draft. Not because the United States, one of the most powerful countries the world had ever known at the time, was beating the crap out of a poor country that was barely out of the Stone Age. That wasn't the problem with Vietnam. The problem with Vietnam is that your son might get drafted, or that you might get drafted. That was the problem. The war wasn't palatable because of the draft. Richard Nixon understood this. And so Richard Nixon campaigned on many promises, but one of his major promises was to end the draft. Nixon believed that ending the draft was the most effective way to undermine the anti-war movement. Nixon knew that youths would stop protesting the war once the draft was gone. And so the draft ended in 1973, but Nixon resigned over Watergate in 1974. Let's just look at the lies involved in that tiny little time frame from Nixon campaigning on his promise to end the draft and end the draft in 1968 until Nixon's resignation in 1974. March 18, 1969, Nixon personally ordered Operation Menu, starting with breakfast. Breakfast was the first bombing of Cambodia, and breakfast was followed by lunch, and lunch was followed by snack, and snack was followed by dinner, and dinner was followed by supper, and supper was followed by dessert. Isn't that pleasant? The carpet bombing of Cambodia was given the overall name Operation Menu, and it was called breakfast, lunch, snack, dinner, supper, and dessert. The 3,500 bombing sorties resulted in over 500,000 dead civilians in Cambodia. Remember, Cambodia was an ally, much like Pakistan is today. On April 30th of 1970, Nixon gave a televised speech where he said that the U.S. had scrupulously respected Cambodia's neutrality for the last 5 years and had not moved against them. Henry Kissinger parroted these lies in his background briefings to the press. But May 9th, a New York Times article exposed the bombings of Cambodia. Now, Nixon was so furious over this that Nixon made a fateful mistake. He began ordering the FBI to illegally tap phones and other activities that would eventually end in Watergate, in the Watergate cover-up. This attempting to find out who the whistleblower was on the Cambodia bombing was Nixon's first true relationship with the FBI. Where he began these same types of internal spying that would later turn into the whole Watergate cover-up. So for 4 years, Operation Menu remained unknown to Congress, except there was this small group of insiders that included a guy named Gerald Ford, a certain congressman from Michigan and member of the Warren Commission. Gerald Ford was one of, I think, four or five people in Congress that knew that Cambodia was being bombed and that knew that the president, Nixon, had openly lied about it. Ford was in on that. Now, the Paris Peace Agreement was signed on January 27, 1973, ending the war in Vietnam, but the Nixon administration actually intensified its bombings in Cambodia even after the war in Vietnam was officially over. In retaliation to their government's alliance with Washington, D.C., Cambodians flocked to support the communist Khmer Rouge. The Khmer Rouge unleashed one of the worst slaughters of civilians in the 20th century. So Nixon lied to Congress. Nixon lied to the American people. Nixon bombed civilians in Cambodia. And Nixon pushed the Khmer Rouge into power in Cambodia through his abuse of the old government of Cambodia. I didn't mention Nixon's vice president was Spiro T. Agnew. Spiro T. Agnew. In 1973, when the Watergate stories began to make the news, Gallup polls found that Republican voters wanted Spiro T. Agnew to be the next Republican candidate for president. Now, you would think, well, that should make Nixon happy, right? No. No, actually, Nixon hated Agnew. Nixon brought him on as a vice presidential candidate purely out of the need to unify the party and get those crazy religious right-wingers over there to back Nixon. So Nixon didn't really like Agnew at all. He brought him in because he was convenient and he brought in the votes. So when the Watergate stories began to break, and Gallup polls found that that Republican voters overwhelmingly wanted Agnew as the next Republican candidate. And I might say the second choice in that was Ronald Reagan. Well, Nixon didn't like this at all. On October 10th, 1973, Spiro Agnew resigned and then pled no contest to criminal charges of tax evasion as part of a plea deal. Agnew was accused of accepting over $200,000 in bribes when he was governor of Maryland. Agnew ended up being fined $10,000 and put on 3 years probation for that. Imagine if you took $200,000 in bribes, you think you'd get fined $10,000 and been given 3 years probation? But that's what he got. That was the plea deal. As a result of the no contest plea, judges representing the state of Maryland disbarred Agnew, and they called him morally obtuse. Morally obtuse. The vice president, morally obtuse. Imagine that. Like he would be involved in deception or you know, bribery or theft or tax evasion. Wow, amazing. But here's the funny part of the Agnew story. In 1980, he wrote his memoirs. And in those, he indicated that Nixon and Nixon's chief of staff, a guy named Alexander Haig, had planned to assassinate Agnew if he refused to resign the vice presidency. And he said that Haig told him personally, go quietly or else. So is it possible that a president would actually want to modify who was going to be the next president and would set up his own vice president to be ousted under threat of assassination? Is that possible? Well, a vice president of the United States, former vice president of the United States, said it was possible and it happened. Is it possible that government is that corrupt? Is it possible that the politicians in Washington, D.C. in the 1970s were really that corrupt? Well, they were in the 1960s, remember? LBJ lied, got the United States into a nasty war. 58,000 American soldiers dead. If they'd lie for that in the 60s, and if Kennedy would stand there and lie about the Bay of Pigs while it was happening, and if Eisenhower would stand there and lie when the Soviet Union said, you know what, we caught your spy plane, we got your little spy boy here, we captured him. And yet the president of the United States lied and said, oh, no, it was a weather plane. It was a weather plane. No, it was just a weather plane. You know, weather planes, you know what they, you know how they are. They're like weather balloons. They're falling out of the sky all the time. You never know what those things are going to do. So he lied. So Eisenhower lied. So Kennedy lied. So LBJ lied. So Nixon lied. And then Watergate started breaking out, and Nixon was lying like every time he opened his mouth to try to cover himself for Watergate. And it became clear that this guy that Nixon hated, Agnew, was gaining way too much popularity among Republicans. And so Agnew had to be taken down, and Agnew was out of the picture. And in his own words, he was threatened with assassination by Alexander Haig and by Nixon if he didn't go quietly. Can we believe that kind of a outrageous story from a vice president? Why would he lie? So Nixon needed a new vice president, Gerald Ford. Gerald Ford, Warren Commissioner. Gerald Ford, insider on Operation Menu. Gerald Ford, the personal friend of J. Edgar Hoover. Gerald Ford, the asset of the FBI. Gerald Ford became the 40th Vice President of the United States. And on August 9th, 1974, Nixon resigned. Gerald Ford became the first unelected U.S. President in history. Now, that's kind of funny because that happened on August 9th, 1974, when Nixon resigned. And on September 8th, less than 1 month later, 1974, Gerald Ford granted Nixon a full, free, and absolute pardon, which ended any possibility of a criminal indictment against Richard Nixon. Any crime that he had done, any and all crimes that he had done, he now had a full, complete, free pardon. I remember vividly when that happened. I just stood stunned that that took place, that government was that corrupt on that level. And I was just a teenager. I was a teenager, but I had already witnessed a lifetime within that small teenage life. I had watched a lifetime of my government lying to me. And it's not my government, is it? Isn't that wrong when we say that? When we say, it's our government? It's not our government. We don't run it. We don't control it. I've talked before about how your vote doesn't change government. Your vote means nothing. Your vote is nothing other than you petitioning government. The same, it's essentially like prayer. It's like petitioning an idol with prayer. And that's what a vote is. You can't change government with your vote. So it's not yours. It's not your government. That's taking ownership over your master. That's like saying, well, this is my master. It kind of puts ownership there and kind of gives legitimacy to the slavery that's taking place. It's not my government. They're not my master. They may be aggressors. They may beat me. They may take what I own. But they're not mine. They're just a gang of thieves. They're nothing more. That's all they are. They're liars. They're thieves. And if you think the government today in 2013 is somehow miraculously different than it was in 1960, 1965, 1970, 1975, then you got another thing coming to you, because it's the same. It's the same now. It's the same as it always has been. If you go back in history and you think about what I started talking about in the early part of this podcast with the War of 1812 and the lies, and you go into the next major war that the U.S. went into, which was the Mexican War, where the U.S. aggressively attacked a weakened country, a country that had just been through years and years of civil war, and the United States government thought that it would be a cakewalk. They thought they could just march right on down there and take all the way down. The United States government fully believed that they could take the whole Mexican country all the way down to Panama. They believed that, and therefore they acted on it by attacking Mexico. And in the end, they ended up taking parts of Mexico, California, Arizona, New Mexico, parts of Texas, Utah. They took that part of Mexico, and the Mexican government was too weak to do anything about it. But then they ended up paying war reparations and giving Mexico back massive amounts of cash in order to keep the peace with the Mexican government. And so they lied. They lied back then. They lied, as I showed in my war series. They lied on every war, every single war. The United States government lied about it, lied to get into it, lied as the war went through its phases. So now, I teased a couple weeks ago, or maybe a week ago or something, about talking about Ronald Reagan. Well, I took you in this just today. I talked about the lies that I was told by my government. My government, remember? My master, my government. I was told by the government. I was taught these things as a child by government schools and through the media, the government-approved media, that is. And all these lies that I've talked about today only stretch from 1960 to 1975. And in 1976, Jimmy Carter became the president of the United States. Well, I don't have time to talk about the lies that Carter was involved in, and I don't have time today to talk about the lies that Ronald Reagan was involved in. But in reference to that, and maybe just to tease to another, and give another Ronald Reagan tease, just keep this in mind. I talked about this before, that after the attempted assassination of Ronald Reagan, which, by the way, put George Herbert Walker Bush, Papa Bush, into power. But before Papa Bush was sworn in, there was an attempt to become president by Alexander Haig using legal technicalities. Do you recall that? Are you old enough to remember that Alexander Haig attempted to use that moment as an excuse to become president? Alexander Haig. Here's one other thing to think about before I let you go today. Have you ever seen the video footage of Ronald Reagan being shot? It's very dramatic. It's hard to look at, actually. But there's one particular camera angle that you can watch it, and you can find this on the internet, and you slow it down and go as slow as you can get it to go, frame by frame if you have to, and watch what happens. As the shooter appears out of the crowd and begins shooting, immediately Ronald Reagan's head kind of pops up like a hen turkey hearing a male turkey. Well, if you're not a turkey hunter, that probably doesn't make any sense. Okay, so when the shooting first starts, Ronald Reagan his eyes kind of pop open and he looks around like, hey, what's going on? At that time, Ronald Reagan aides are in the way and being effectively shot down by Hinckley, the shooter. And again, you have to get the video and watch it and go frame by frame and listen to the sounds of the shots as you're doing this. And you'll find that the first few shots hit Reagan aides. And then as that's happening, the Secret Service guys rush in to protect Ronald Reagan. And one of them actually pins his arms around Ronald Reagan's body and sort of drives Ronald Reagan into the limousine that's waiting for him. And in a not a very comfortable fashion, because he's just basically tackling Reagan and throwing him into the door, into the open door. But here's the funny part now. At that moment in time, you can actually see a bullet hit the window of the limousine with Ronald Reagan right on the other side of that window. A bullet actually hits the window. Of course, the window is bulletproof, and the bullet did not penetrate the window. But at what point did Ronald Reagan get shot? Going from the official description of how it happened, all of the first shots missed Reagan. They're all accounted for. According to the official record, the final shot that actually hit Ronald Reagan first hit the side of the body of the limousine, traveled down the body of the limousine, went between the door, right where the hinges are on the door. It went between the door and the body. The bullet slid down the body of the limousine, went between the door and the body, somehow went around the body of the Secret Service agent who was protecting Ronald Reagan's body, and evidently went up underneath the arm of the Secret Service agent, entered Reagan in his ribs, and went within an inch of his heart. Now, a lot of people who have studied the Kennedy assassination, and there's been a lot of talk of the so-called magic bullet that had to change courses and go in different directions and do all these things in order for the single shooter theory of the assassination of JFK to be correct. A lot of people have gone into a lot of study of that. But did you know that witnesses at the moment that the attempted assassination of Ronald Reagan took place, did you know that witnesses said that there was a second shooter that was up on the balcony above, on the walkway above where Ronald Reagan was standing? Did you know about that? There's quite a few witnesses that have said that. You see, another problem, though, what I was just describing with that bullet is, if that bullet actually did what they say it did, it slid down the body of the car, went between the door and the body, went underneath the arm of the Secret Service agent, penetrated within 1 inch of Reagan's heart, and then it did a funny thing. You know, we're told that this evil assassin, this crazed lunatic, this lone killer, we're told that he used this special kind of ammunition, devastator bullets. And when this first happened with Ronald Reagan, it was all over the news that this horrible assassin had attempted to use these exploding bullets. They used that terminology. They called it the exploding bullets. And the story went so far as to say that when they had Ronald Reagan on the operating table and they were removing this bullet that was within an inch of his heart and that it almost killed him, that the surgeons were actually under danger of this exploding bullet because it, their words, they said this in the press releases, because it hadn't exploded yet. That's what they said, that the bullet had entered the president and gone within an inch of his heart, but somehow had not exploded yet. And so they had to be especially careful in the operating room to not disturb the bullet because they didn't want it to explode and hurt the surgeons. Of course, all of that is a lie. There was no exploding bullet. Devastator bullets do not explode. They have a chemical function that causes them to expand rapidly, but they do not explode. They do not fragment. A fragmenting bullet is the opposite of what you want to do what the Devastator bullet is designed to do. The Devastator bullet is designed to open up like a mushroom and fan out so that it causes as much bleeding as possible and so that it doesn't penetrate and go all the way through whatever it is you're shooting. So let's say if you're shooting a deer or a rabbit, it doesn't matter. Once it enters the body, the purpose of the Devastator bullet is to fan out and cut as much flesh as possible, causing as much bleeding as possible. That's what that bullet is designed to do. And now we're told by these people that Ronald Reagan was shot and that the bullet went all the way into his body and almost to his heart, and it didn't open. It didn't mushroom out. And yet we're also told that it slid down the body of the car for several feet before going underneath the body of the Secret Service agent and penetrating Ronald Reagan's body. And yet we're still told that it was an exploding bullet. None of these facts seem to be facts. So there's my teaser for another episode about Ronald Reagan and the lies that the government has told us. Folks, thanks for listening today, and remember to visit badquaker.com, where liberty is our mission. Thanks a lot, folks. Goodbye.